What's up, ladies and gentle thems, and welcome back to the Shinigami Love Apples podcast, episode 12. I'm Shinigami Pin Pin, joined as always by Shinigami Yu Yu, and we're here with a very, very special episode. Our first ever, I don't know what you would call it. I would say bonus episode, but technically it's taking the place of the episode we would normally do
it's,
for today.
It's not a bonus as in extra. It's a bonus as in different.
Different. Yeah. So if you've listened to our podcast for any length of time, because we are now, as hard as it is to believe, like 3 months into podcasting, like holy shit, where did the time go? If you're used to our normal format, we normally do the first half of sort of like meme-y, pop culture-y stuff. And then the second half, we get onto what we call serious shit. We talk about serious topics. Well, today's one is just straight up, not a serious topic, but like, I don't know. It's a real topic. And we're going to kind of skip out on the anime and waifus for for a week, which is, let's be honest, is probably healthy for all of us.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about technology and Japan. And to kind of give you some background on why we're doing this, Japan is a mystical land for most people who digest Japanese pop culture.
Yeah.
There's kind of one of two perspectives. Either you view Japan as this ancient entity with incredibly storied history, and it's just, you know, crazy old and traditional and formal. That's fine. A lot of that's true. Japan is an extremely ancient culture. It's just younger than China and Korea, so it's up there. But then you have the other half of people who view Japan as this futuristic wonderland where everything's crazy, flying cars and robots that do everything, and AI is fucking bonkers.
Yeah.
And the weird thing is, Japan actually is neither of these things.
Yeah. Well, it's all like media-focused stuff, right? Because you either watched samurai ninja movies, or you watched
like Gundam.
Cyberpunk.
Or
stuff.
Cyberpunk, yeah. So we're here today to kind of do a special episode that kind of covers Japan's relationship with technology. And we're gonna do this in like three little sections. And I didn't prepare any visuals for our Twitch viewers, so that sucks for them. I probably could have. But, you know, we're lazy sometimes. But we're going to cover like three sections, and then we're going to talk about some companies that are really forward-thinking on the topic. And I'm going to be your history teacher for the first half, and then Yu's going to absolutely let you have it with some really cool projects and shit for the second half. And we'll talk in between, obviously. I'm not going
to
just talk.
No, I'm going to be dead silent.
It's just going to be fucking awkward. But to start off with, I want to talk about Japan's history with technology. So one of the interesting things about Japan is Japan had a meteoric rise as a financial or economic, I guess would be the technical word, an economic, political, and scientific superpower. The United States has sort of been a scientific superpower since the Industrial Revolution in the 1800s. So the U.S. has been on this pretty steady linear climb since the 1800s. Japan, not so. Japan's rise has been sort of exponential with a couple flat lines and plateaus in between where things didn't go so well.
Yeah.
So to kind of give you all some background, Japan's technological revolution started much later than the U.S.'s, and it started in around 1860, 1870, something called the Five Charter Oath. So this is during the Meiji period. So the Meiji period, this is post-Edo period. So Edo period Japan is where most folks are familiar with old traditional Japan. If you watch like Demon Slayer, you've seen Edo era Japan, right? The advent of the electric light, the advent of the horse-drawn cart, or not advent, but like the huge use of nice horse-drawn carts. Bigger buildings, the early days of earthquake proofing, all that stuff. That's Edo period. The Meiji period follows the Edo period and is kind of the first time Japan admitted that maybe being closed off as they had been for, at this point, almost 200 to 300 years, probably not the best bet.
Yeah.
So the Five Charter Oath, which was created by the Japanese at the time, sort of like the Japanese Imperial, Imperial Senate. This is not Star Wars. But the Japanese Imperial leadership decided that they needed to embrace Western culture more. So the Five Charter Oath essentially said that it listed five goals for Japan. And the one that I'm most focused on for our needs today is, or purpose today is, it says, we will seek knowledge throughout the world to strengthen the Japanese Empire.
Yeah.
And Japan, up to this point, had adopted an attitude that's kind of hard to understand in Western nations. Japan genuinely didn't give a shit about anybody. Mm. When the U.S. first came to Japan, Commodore Matthew Perry came in massive American gunboats.
Yeah.
Japan had never done war on the seas and had a navy like that. So just right off the bat, just talking militarism, Japan was blown away by the fact that that was even a thing. It's like,
yeah,
boats that have guns.
Yeah.
Like, Japan had guns. They had muskets and rifles. They'd used them to solve a lot of their civil strife, but not men of war with fucking 150 guns on each side, like, or 150 guns total. It's like, Jesus, these things are huge. So Japan was kind of blown away that Western nations were so far ahead of them. Mm. And interestingly, something I found fascinating, Japan wasn't really intimidated by it.
Yeah.
Which very much fits the Japanese mentality of, like, concerned but not intimidated.
Right. Well, it is kind of a funny thing, too, because, like, if you're doing naval warfare, but only one team has boats, what are you fighting?
That's very one side. Yeah.
Sure, you could hit some like coastline stuff, but like.
Well, funnily enough, when one of Japan's most famous naval battles, I guess you could say, I don't remember its exact name. I could probably look it up, but to focus on this episode, they had some major fight off of Kagoshima in the southern island of Kyushu, and a series of typhoons came through and wiped out the enemy forces. The Japanese Navy didn't even have to fight twice, actually, back to back. So Japan has this interesting belief in the 1800s that military conflict, both on the seas and in land, is unnecessary.
Right.
Except when pursuing colonial interests, you know, conquering China and Korea,
yeah,
which is what Japan was doing at the time. So Japan meeting a vastly superior superpower is sort of a, oh shit.
Yeah.
We're not as cool as we think we are.
Yeah.
So in the late 1880s, Japanese society and Japanese culture began to adopt Westernisms, mostly in the realms of like fashion, arts, music, that sort of thing. Because at the time, Japan's culture was it was so homogenous, you could even call it boring. The Japanese, by their own admission, said that like early Meiji period was boring as shit.
Yeah.
Just like there was nothing going on.
Yeah.
And then you had this massive bloom in the Meiji era of art, science, fashion, music, and all that. Mm. And the Japanese government felt intimidated that the Japanese people were embracing Western culture so much. So like, oh shit, well, if we're going to embrace Western culture, we should probably embrace the commercially lucrative side of it too, which would mean manufacturing, the Industrial Revolution, railways,
right,
that sort of thing. And the most obvious example is the Japanese rail system, which, by the way, is one of the earliest fully fledged national rail systems in the globe.
Mm.
Well, not the first. England has that boast, and then India right after them. But Japan was third, and they have, like, by the 1910s, they had covered the entire country in rail.
Mm.
Every ounce of it. Now, this isn't fair to the U.S., because the U.S. is a much larger country to have to cover with rail.
Right.
So if you want to get into the whole, like, who had rail going, America really knows rail. But Japan turned it in, they nationalized it.
Yeah.
They made this national system, so the government controlled the rail system.
Mm.
And at first you're like, well, that doesn't sound very useful. But it's like, it is, because everything's standardized.
Yeah.
Trains are on strict timetables. You know where everything is. You have great communication, because trains are much faster than sending a horse.
Right.
So you've got great communication, great sourcing of goods, and great manufacturing and distribution of goods.
Yeah.
And Japan's economy pre-World War I developed differently than the U.S.'s. The U.S. economy began to go, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, what we call the convenience route, where scientific advancements were to make people more comfortable. Japan's scientific advancements in the late 1800s and 1900s were to make people more successful, whether it be militarily, commercially, health, whatever. They didn't care about whether or not you had a bidet that cleaned your ass. They didn't care if you had a nice car with a fan in it, an air movement. They just made what they needed to get by.
Yeah.
Very pragmatic, which again is kind of very Japanese. So then you come into World War I. In World War I, the U.S. and the European powers made one sort of fatal financial mistake, which is just the necessity of war. They ignored everybody else.
Yeah.
And to be fair, war is kind of like putting blinders on. When you're at war, it's really hard to relate to anyone else.
Yeah.
Just ask Ukraine. And like, I'm not trying to make light of a bad situation, but if you were to go to Ukraine and be like, hey, Ukraine, how's your relationship with Germany? Ukraine probably is like, oh shit, I forgot about them.
Yeah, we got more important things to think
it's
about.
It's not that they hate any other nations. It's just, it's really hard to keep your focus when you have so much going on. So with all of the European powers and the U.S. absorbed in World War One, and Japan is just sort of, they were involved, but they were part of the Allies actually back then, but they just, they weren't really involved. It was a European war. And so Japan's like, well, we have all this military economic might we built up. What do we do with it?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, I guess we'll turn it into a manufacturing superpower. Mm. And so they began building, they began to mimic the U.S. model of wartime industry.
Yeah.
So World War One finishes, and Japan decides that in addition to centralizing and nationalizing all of its manufacturing, which, you know, that's probably not a healthy thing. Mm-hmm. Government-controlled manufacturing is like, competition can be a good thing. If you're going to have any capitalism at all, maybe have a little competition.
Yeah.
But they did, as part of that, institutionalize and centralize science. Now, that was a good fucking call. Because remember, this is pre-World War II. Yeah. So Japan is about to learn a shit ton of science the hard way. And I'm not trying, you know, it's funny, right? But I'm not trying to make light of it, but they were about to learn a lot in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
So World War II comes by. Japan, obviously, as part of the losing side, unconditionally surrendering, has two cities reduced to ash, completely uninhabitable due to nuclear fallout. Their population is in an absolute shambles trying to figure out how they could lose a holy war in their mind because the emperor is God and the emperor just surrendered. That's not great culturally. So now you're trying to climb out of this mess. And they went into this massive, massive depression, like unrivaled economic depression. And that's when Japan experienced something called the Kodo Keizai Seicho, which is the post-war economic miracle. And it is the greatest economic and financial achievement in world history. There is no other financial achievement like it. No one has ever imitated it since, and none before have ever gotten close.
Yeah.
During this time, at the time of World War II concluding, Japan only had 25% of its manufacturing left. It had been so financially devastated by losing the war and having to pay reparations and factories actually being bombed and damaged and lost all their islands and all the goods they were importing from the islands.
Right.
Japan was just gone. So they looked at World War II and went, we need to recover. What can we do? Well, they had 25% left of their factories and infrastructure, but they had 100% of their resources and 100% of their labor.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people and a lot of stuff not being turned into things.
Right.
So Japan went, let's just turn everybody into commercial. Everybody. Everybody's going to work in a factory building stuff.
Yeah.
And the things they chose to work in was technology. Japan just looked at the market and went, where is there any opportunity for us to financially recover? We're not going to compete with America in like automotive at the time. They were very paranoid. This is pre-Japan, like pre-Toyota during their boom years, I guess.
Yeah.
Like Japan's automotive wasn't what it is today. So they were like, well, what can we compete with? Well, we can't compete with Detroit. We can't compete with aviation, especially with Airbus and Boeing. Can't do that.
Yeah.
We can't compete with medical science in Europe. What's left? And they're like, well, the world is discovering computers. And so Japan invested all of their manufacturing, and I do mean all of it, divested almost all of its finances into developing transistor technology and computer technology. And by 1995, from 1960 to 1995, they experienced a 12,000% increase in their GDP. 120 times. I don't mean to exaggerate. If you're a person, right, and you make a salary and you're making, I don't know, the average salary for an American, you know, 50 grand a year or so, I want you to understand what you're now making. You went from making 50 grand a year to is that number right? Yes. Yes. No. 6.2. Yeah. 6 million. Why did I doubt myself? Man,
yeah, you're the one that does math. I don't fucking, 2 + 2 = 4, I guess. That's about as deep as my math
six
goes.
Yeah. 6 million. You've gone from making $50,000 a year to $6 million a year. What the fuck? That is a huge, even if it was over, in this case, 35 years.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go from making 50 grand.
Yeah.
It's 6 million in 35 years.
Right.
Unless I'm the next unicorn billionaire.
Yeah.
But Japan did. And this triggered two things. One, Japan began creating institutions designed to centralize their science and begin learning from it, which created the superpower Toshiba, Sony, these Japanese technology Hitachi. These Japanese companies quickly rose to power because they were just getting funneled all of this money from Japan's economic miracle.
Yeah.
And they immediately became dominant in the computer era in the 80s. And it's interesting because it was such a miracle that the fucking Reagan administration fucking cucks.
Gotta love the Reagan administration.
I love America so much. And if you don't detect sarcasm in my voice, you're as autistic as me. Yeah. But, but like the fucking Reagan administration, this is actually the beginning of Japan's counterculture in the US of Americans hating Japan because it's weeby and weird.
Yeah.
It started in the Reagan administration because the Reagan administration, and I quote, said that they created a strong anti-Japanese sentiment in the U.S. because they wanted it to lead to greater competition and less collaboration between the two nations. They felt that they were at a trade deficit and they felt at a disadvantage to the Japanese.
Yeah.
And so America revitalized its economy in sort of to compete with Japan's economic miracle.
Yeah.
And then from the 1980s to now have brands like Microsoft, Apple, IBM, which have sadly surpassed Japanese companies at this point. Like Japanese technology is not what it used to be.
Yeah.
And that takes us to kind of the myths about tech. And the thing is, there's a lot of things foreigners think about Japan that are just completely wonk. One, Japan's communication technology is on the level of like Star Trek. No, it's fucking not.
Yeah.
Japan still uses those landline phones, a lot of landline phones and fax machines. And the thing is, Japan created the mobile technology in modern radios as we know them, both of those things, right? And, you know, look at Motorola. Motorola single-handedly just changed and revolutionized the radio industry.
Yeah.
And then same with phones. But despite being the single-handed force that created them, they also spawned competition in Apple and Samsung that now have vastly, like, when's the last time you bought a Motorola? Like, it's beyond,
yeah, the Razor back in, like, 2012 or not even that.
No,
like older, 2007.
Like yeah. Seven, so like it's been a while. And the worst part is because Japanese brands can't keep up with Western brands, they don't get funding. And not having funding means they don't innovate. And this cycle just continues. Second, Japan has crazy computers and digital technology everywhere. No, actually, Japan has one of the slowest adoptions of computer technology in the world.
Mm.
Only 40% of Japan's population has interacted only 40% has not interacted with computers on a daily basis.
Wow.
40% of Japan's population would be uncomfortable using digital technology on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of this is due to Japan being an extremely advanced aged society because they do have almost over a third of their population is over the age of 60.
Yeah.
Fine. But the thing is, the reason they continue to use the fax machine and paper documentation and landline phones and analog technology is just because the other 40% would not know what to do if Japan became digital. And nobody's pushing digital technology to the countryside, which is where that 40% live. Mm. The Midwest and the US, people in the Midwest probably know how to use a computer.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. At the very least.
I know a guy that lives in a smaller town in like Iowa. Yeah, Iowa. And he just moved there, and he was talking about like the process of moving and getting his car registered and all that stuff. Everything was done online. He didn't have to go in person at all. And I'm like, some of my other buddies that live in different states were like, damn, we still had to like print papers and stuff. Like, how come Iowa of all these places is the most technologically advanced in that case?
Japan's struggling to even get the technology into the hands of people who are going to use it daily.
Yeah.
Another myth. Japan has flying cars and crazy AI cars.
Oh, shit.
No, they fucking don't. Japan's automobile industry is very unique. Mm. Japan is a believer in the status quo. We've talked about this in many episodes before. At this point, people are tired of hearing it, but it's true. Japan is a high uncertainty avoidance culture.
Yeah.
They will not change things if they know what's working now is doing its job well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Japanese automotive, Toyota, right? Help me with some other brands because my brain just died halfway through.
It's Toyota, Honda, and Mitsubishi.
Nissan.
Oh, yeah, Nissan. What's the one that starts with an I?
Wow, you just threw my... I don't know why my brain just died trying to think of...
They made like the... Was it the Ninja? The little like...
Oh, you mean car Kawasaki? That would, no.
No, no. Kawasaki is bikes. Fuck. It's right on the tip of my tongue. It's like Isuzu something.
Isuzu, no.
No, not that.
Yeah, I'm close. Hold on.
I know. It's like right there.
Isuzu Motors.
It is.
Isuzu.
Okay.
Yeah, Isuzu. Anyway, all these, geez, guys, we promise we did a lot of research for this. Yeah. Hey, please ignore the struggles. But the Japanese automobile industry specializes in making cars that worked in the 1980s and 90s and just tweaking them to be more attractive by modern standards and have a few more modern amenities.
Yeah. That's more so common here in the States, I would say, because they have K cars, which dominates a lot of things because they need tiny little cars that are fuel efficient and easy to work on.
And simple. Yeah. That's the big thing, right? Don't change the formula because it works. Japan's cars are simple, cheap, affordable, easily constructible, recyclable, all of it.
Yeah.
So, no, Japan is not adopting smart technology, AI, or other future-forward technologies into automotive. In fact, Japan leads the world in cynical distrust of automation and driving. And part of this is probably because Japan doesn't drive as much. You know, only 60% of the population even owns a car, let alone less than that, actively drive.
Yeah.
But they just don't trust technology being put into their cars, which is ironic considering they came up with a lot of it. But they just don't. Another myth, Japan uses robotics for everything. Now, this is interesting because it's founded in fact, but it's the wrong fact for the wrong myth. Mm. The myth is Japan uses robotics for everything. You're correct. The folks are correct. Japan has the highest density in the world of robots to human population.
Yeah.
And that's pretty impressive given there's 180 million. That's half the U.S. population. That's, or I guess they're lower now. I'm sorry. I'm probably misquoting that population number.
Oh, yeah. I don't know.
I'm actually... Hold on. I'm pretty sure it's like down to, it's 125 million as 2022. I'm sorry. At least I corrected myself before I got the hate mail. Anyway, 120 mil. That's still a pretty impressive figure. When you think there's 125 mil and there's a huge proportion of robotics, but that robotics is used in industrial and automotive manufacturing. Almost all of Japan's robotics are not humanoid.
I think people think when they think of robots, they think of, like
Osimo.
Oh, yeah.
Or like...
I was going to say like iRobot or the Terminator or something. Yeah. But people, I think, forget that those little mechanical arms are robots.
They're robots, in fact, there's a company called Kyoka. Kyoka Robotics that builds and specializes in these like robotic arms. They're often used on rides and stuff too. And sure, the technology is cool, but they're not what you think of when you think robots. When you say robots to an anime fan or whatever, right? And we love anime. Sure. We love Gundam and all that. That's cool. But like, that's not where Japan's going with robotics. Japan is developing robotics for practical purposes. Again, they're not really into the whole, like, we want them to be attractive and androidy. That's not what they're going for. Yeah. And then lastly, the myth is that Japan is leading the world in embracing clean energy and nuclear power. Oh boy, oh boy. That's not true. Mm-hmm. Especially post 2011 earthquake. After the great East Japan earthquake or the Tohoku earthquake, Japan literally shat itself in terror of nuclear power. 90% of the population in 2011 after earthquake wanted it abolished, gone, not decommissioned over time, shredded. Today, as of 2022, at least, this is this article, as of 2022, 49% of the Japanese population still wants nuclear power decommissioned actively, even if that means losing access to clean energy.
Yeah.
So Japan is not embracing it. They're still running coal and natural gas.
Yeah. I was telling you earlier, I saw this TikTok of this girl that just kind of like went to Japan on a whim. And she was going around Tokyo and she was like, so you saw a bunch of people gathering in this like downtown space and they're all like, they got food and like, you know, they're handing out pamphlets stuff. Yeah. And she's like, she just wandered in, she's getting this food. She's like, it was so delicious. Got some teriyaki or whatever. And then she like walked into this like a guy on a stage saying something. She doesn't know any Japanese. So she's just like, oh, this is kind of passionate. And then she later found out that she was there at like a protest against nuclear power. And she's like, I don't think I was supposed to be there.
But the food was so good.
Yeah.
And they treated me so nice. Yeah. So no, Japan definitely not embracing clean energy. And before we move on to like the positives about Japanese technology and then UU's section on kind of like the tech we love about Japan.
Yeah.
There's an article by a financial company called McKinsey and Company, and they're financial researchers, and they specialize in the Japanese economy. And they wrote an article called How Japan Can Become Digitally Competitive by 2030. And the biggest thing is they have some statistics I want to read out really quick that are just the ultimate. I warn you in advance. Actually, I'm going to give a quick trigger warning. If you're super passionate about Japan and you live in this blind world where Japan has no flaws and it's perfect in every way, just stop listening. Because what I'm about to say is going to shatter a lot of your reality, and that can be really heartbreaking. Yeah. The whole Santa Claus isn't real bit. This could hurt a little.
Or just stand up, take a deep breath, do a lap around the house, and then sit down with the correct mindset.
Yeah, because we're not saying this to shit on Japan, because of all people, we adore Japan. But there is a reality here. So in digital and global competitiveness, Japan's overall productivity ranking is fifth behind China, the US, and Singapore, and a couple other nations. That productivity is also, unfortunately, considered to be false productivity. And what false productivity means is folks are going to work, but not a lot is getting done.
Mm.
Japan has a lot of hustle, a lot of grind, but not a lot of result for the grind.
Yeah.
For digital competitiveness, Japan ranks 27th out of 130 nations in the world that are currently providing this data. Japan's 27th.
Yeah.
There are second world and third world nations ahead of Japan.
Mm.
Ouch. And US and Singapore leading. Digital talent, only 29 universities, and there are way more than that in Japan, only 29 have software-related programs that lead to a degree.
Yeah.
That's the important thing, that lead to a degree. The US has 117, and that's just bachelor's programs.
Yeah.
We're not getting into master's and doctorates, right? Only 1% of Japan's population works as digital talent. In other words, designers, coders, software engineers, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
3% in the US, and it's really worth pointing out that the US is not reporting freelance.
Right.
Japan is. So Japan is 1% including freelance workers. The US has 3% not including, and I promise you, just the number of people I know who know how to code or know how to do web dev is way easily 5-10%.
Yeah.
In digital industry, e-commerce, which is currently the number one way to make money for any corporation, any sort of online marketing.
Yeah.
Only 9%. Yikes. China is leading with 24%.
Mm.
And China's not pushing that figure. That's a naturally organically derived figure. China, just by the nature of the businesses it creates, is driving 24%. Yeah. Japan is shoving digital technology in its citizens' faces and still only managing 9%. That's rough. that's retail. Healthcare, 5%. What?
Mm.
What are you doing? Paperwork? Paper? What do you want? Like the medical industry, 31% in Saudi Arabia, which I totally believe because they have the cash. But the US and again Singapore right behind, Canada. You're not digitizing your healthcare industry?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Finance, 6.9.
Right.
As opposed to 35% in the rest of the world, by the way, averages 30.
Yeah. From an American perspective, because most quote unquote indie banks are, their whole gimmick is that they're only online, which is why you save money in fees. And even like the big banks like Chase and Bank of America, they're all of them digital. Are moving to this fully digital model, and they just have like little hotspots for people that need to still cash checks.
Just blow, wow.
But yeah, we don't do that shit anymore.
Like, here's one. Useful government apps, including a warning and alert systems, which you would think, okay, Japan, earthquakes, tsunamis, definitely subscribe. Nuh-uh. 7.5% of the population gives a shit.
Yeah.
As opposed to the top ranking nation, Estonia, where 99% are using provided apps of their own free will.
Yeah.
And the last two things I want to do is smart city ranking. This is interesting. In terms of the amount of digital penetration into the market from technology, Japan and Tokyo, the leading city for smart city ranking, is 79th. Man.
Yeah.
When you think modern Japan, Tokyo, Osaka, and Kyoto all come to mind because they are all modern cyberpunkian cities. Tokyo somehow is leading the three of them, and the rest don't even clock on the radar.
Yeah.
This one is 79th. That's not a good number. Singapore, number one. And then the last thing is startup economies. Only 1% of Japan's total market capacity is startups.
Yeah.
Wow. I don't know whether to laugh or cry at the number.
Yeah.
Because as an American, I have personal friends who've tried starting businesses. Yeah. Hell, I guess if we're us trying to create a podcast is kind of, sort of, eventually aiming to start a business.
Yeah.
There's a lot of entrepreneurial spirit there. What is Japan doing to snuff that? 1% of your total market cap is for startups?
Right.
Where's the other money going? You really believe in corporate power, I guess.
Yeah.
The US, by the way, as a comparison, is 31.
Yeah.
Which is just It's kind of easy to say down with the corporations when you have 31% market cap and just in entrepreneurial efforts.
Yeah.
And by the way, Japan has only produced 5 what are called unicorn startups. So a startup that is valuated at greater than $1 billion before it goes public. Only 5.
Yeah.
As opposed to, ready for it, 320.
Yeah.
In the US in the last decade. Whoa. Okay. I just heard a lot of negative figures, and it's easy to just bog down. Here's the thing, right? Japan is struggling.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the myths about Japan's technology is because Japan is stagnated. It's in population decline. Folks are leaving the rural countryside. They're moving to the cities. They're finding that the life of a salary man or woman is not very enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to go into science and into STEM when they can go to the United States and join STEM, go to Britain and join STEM, go to France, go to these other more avant-garde places and make more money and have a better life in that regard. And the last few stats I want to point out are kind of encouraging. Japan is currently 13th in the Global Innovation Index. Mm-hmm. From the World Economic Forum. 13th. China ranks 11th. Korea 6th. US 3rd. There's good and bad to this. The bad is obviously that they're 13th. But the good news is Japan is still in the top 10% of nations capable of achieving technological superiority in any one industry. So the good news is they still have the foundations for it. Japan also has the third largest economy in the world right now, with almost 80% of its economy dedicated to STEM research and development.
Mm.
The money's there.
Yeah.
Japan is shoving money into its technology universities and into its manufacturing and its industry. They're just not innovating with that money.
Yeah.
So now we're down to people. Japan's technology industries contribute to 50% of its GDP.
Yeah.
Remember when I said 10% for automotive? Man, I lowballed. I thought it was, remember we talked about in the car? I thought I was highballing. I'm like, oh, 10%. I probably exaggerated. I'll have to backpedal. Nope. I was wrong. I was under 50.
Yeah.
50. Motherfucker. That's a lot of market capacity.
Yeah.
But again, that's industrial and automotive, wholesale and retail, healthcare and financial services.
Mm.
All of these industries are analog.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you digitized any of these, just the growth would be explosive. In fact, predictions from like McKinley and company, that, you know, the organization I was talking about that did the financial review, they predict that if Japan put in its finance for these industries straight into the developmental side of it, Japan would experience threefold growth year on year, which doesn't sound that much, like threefold. Okay, what? No, that's 300%. 300% growth year on year is astronomical. We're talking Facebook, Twitter, TikTok levels of growth.
Yeah.
If only they just put the money into it. And then the last thing is Japan is a global leader in space exploration, aerospace, and research technologies for space.
Mm.
And because of that, they've been critical to all of satellite distribution in the last 30 years, into navigational satellite network creation in the last 30 years. They've been part of every ISS mission since 1990.
Yeah.
And they've also been one of the first nations to forward female astronauts and begin breaking inclusivity barriers in terms of scientific research towards aerospace and engineering. So there's a lot of encouraging factors there. It's just Japan isn't utilizing what it has. And like we're about to talk about, so for the last half, you're going to talk about kind of companies and tech that we love, because these companies and the people we're about to talk about they're the really encouraging bit. I know I kind of just spent 30 minutes talking about some stuff that people are going to find depressing. Like, oh, what the fuck, man, I really wish I didn't listen to this. But the second half is worth it because Japan's not lost. They have not fallen so far from financial grace that Japan is destroyed. Yeah. In fact, if anything, it's a great place to go for opportunity.
Yeah. Basically, despite all the metrics you just spewed off, they're still doing some incredible things.
Yes.
So,
what do you got first? One of my favorites, by the way, first, right off the bat.
Well, I wanted to do this one first because this is kind of what introduced me into everything to begin with, was is a company called Ori Labs.
Yes. Yeah.
I need to find the main guy's name here. Kentaro Yoshifuji.
Okay.
So he, just to give a little bit of a backstory about him, because this is really like, it's really interesting. Something happened to him. I was trying to find the story and I couldn't find it in like a condensed manner.
I
but
remember
he,
from his, he did a video on his channel. He was ill. He was traumatically
when he was in high school. Yeah, he was ill and he couldn't leave. So he was like stuck at home.
Yeah.
And he got super lonely, and that kind of became a bit of a passion of his, is like he didn't want to be alone, and he knew that there's other people less fortunate than him that were subjected to the same lifestyle where they just couldn't really do things.
Isolated, yeah.
Later in life, his friend had, I can't remember again if it was medical or if it was an accident, but he's completely paralyzed, can't do anything. And when he was in college, so Yoshi Fuji just had like a natural love of science and was just, he happened to go to college for artificial intelligence, which all like perfectly lined up because one day he was talking with his friend, he was visiting him, and he was like, they were talking about loneliness and stuff. And he was like, honestly, the worst part is even though you come over and talk to me, I can't do anything. I just lay here and I could say words and I'll, you know, if you put your face in front of me, I could look at you.
Yeah.
But I can't do anything. And then that sparked this interest, which then became Ori Lab, where he set out specifically to make robots that would do things that would allow these less fortunate people to actually go around and see things and talk to people and experience things and get jobs, something that you would never be able to do in a lot of their conditions. And so initially he made, it was kind of two different robots. There's Orihime, which is like the tiny little one.
Yeah.
And then there's the big one called the Orihime D, which is like the taller, I think it's like 4 foot tall.
Yeah, it's close to human height.
Yeah.
Like short, but still.
Yeah. And then on top of that, they made Dawn Cafe.
Yes.
And Dawn Cafe is something that you and I both really want to go to.
I just want. Oh, yes. Sorry. I'm not going to.
Essentially. So he created these robots that were, you know, they had cameras and speakers and microphones and all that stuff so that people that were like bedridden or just couldn't get around easily because of wheelchair access stuff that's not existing wherever they're trying to go. Or like there was this little girl that really wanted to go see a live show, but she has like, she couldn't handle
the
sensory stuff. Yeah. And so like her little kid, like I think it was her dad or something, took her little robot to go see the show. And then she was like watching it via her little robot. You know?
I love it.
Sorry, they created this cafe specifically so they could test these robots. So it's a fully, it's a cafe bar. And they also have a, like a little dinner thing that you could,
I'm seeing that.
They do have reservations for.
Yeah.
But it's all ran by these robots, which are operated by people with disabilities. So it's people that like would normally not have human interaction, could normally get a job. They actually now get paid to sit down. And so the little robots, the original Orihime, sit like on your actual, on your like table.
People. Yeah.
And they'll sit there and talk to you, help you walk through the menu, and then just have a general conversation if you want to talk to them. And then the bigger ones, the Orihime D, those are the ones that actually like hold the tray and then hand you your food. All are operated by humans.
Yep.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, they are not automated. There's no AI or anything in here. Yep.
Yeah. Also, on top of that, originally it was like a touchpad thing, but because fully paralyzed people can't actually touch anything,
right,
they came up with a whole other technology called Orihime Eye, which is an eye tracker that allows people to type out things and give commands just using their eyes.
Yep.
Which is also super sick.
Yeah, it's just
like there's so many things that they thought about. It was like, oh, I'll create this little robot that someone could carry around and take on hiking trips or to a show or something. Yep. And then it was like, oh, but how do they communicate? Oh, I know. I'll just build a fucking eye tracker and allow them to like communicate that way and control robots and things. And it's really cool. Dawn Cafe is a place that is on our bucket list. And
yes,
it looks so exciting. They're opening new locations too. So like they're doing really well.
And for those of you listening, this probably doesn't seem that significant. You're like, okay, yeah, the dude helping people with disabilities. What's so big about this? You have to understand Japan's mindset. Japan does not treat people with disabilities the same way we do.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say that Japan is shitting on people with disabilities because that's not the case. Japan, we were talking about this at home earlier before the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the best way to phrase it. Japan is empathetic. They care. They feel emotion. They feel strongly about folks with disabilities.
Yeah.
But they will not change anything because guess what we just talked about? They won't change the status quo. Mm-hmm. The uncertainty of making Japan disability accessible to a person in America, this sounds like common sense. Like, what the fuck? Of course, adding ramps and adding communications tech and adding a blind individual or hard of visibility individual, having these disability accessible things is great. Yeah. Yes, but you have to understand people are paying for this. People are changing things. The habits are changing to accommodate these folks. I'm not saying we shouldn't. I'm saying think like a Japanese person for a minute. You've done things this way for so long, and now you want to do it different.
Yeah.
It's not that Japan hates people with disabilities, no matter what the negative media will do to you. Mm-hmm. I saw an article. I think you saw the article I put in one of ours, which is like a theater coming down on someone who is in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
That is definitely the exception, not the rule. Japan wants to help these folks. It's just Japan is a definite don't make noise, don't make a big fuss, don't draw attention culture.
Yeah.
Just don't do it. Be quiet, shut the fuck up, and sit down. But this is so hard when you have a disability. I have a disability. I am a neurodivergent. I have a very strong level of autism. I don't know how to phrase. I never know how to phrase this. I am autistic. I am just verbal. I'm just on the positive side of verbal through years and years and years of therapy and a lot of time in the educational system. And because of that, I'm a functioning autistic adult. But I am on that fringe where as I age, that might become less true. And as certainly as a child, that was not true. Yeah. So in Japan, I would have been an annoyance, not because of the disability. People are like, man, Japan is so heartless. No, stop for a minute. Their parents love these children with disabilities. The neighbors love them. Your coworkers love them. That's not what I'm talking about. Yeah. But it's difficult for them to do anything because no one in Japan is empowered to change it. The only way you change things in Japan is by sticking out and you're going to get hammered down. Because why are you standing out? Why are you being so competitive? Why are you being so highfalutin? And if there's a beautiful video, please go watch Ori Labs videos on YouTube.
Yeah.
Just O-R-Y, by the way, if you're looking for their company name, it's Ori Lab, O-R-Y-L-A-B. But their videos on YouTube are heartbreaking because the reality for Yoshifuji is he had to put himself in a societal position where people were going to frown on how noisy he was being about folks with disabilities. Yoshifuji talks in depth on his YouTube channel about how helping people with disabilities has gotten him a lot of positive praise and a lot of flack because he's working in the robotics industry. He's disrupting the Japanese robotics industry. He's doing things that are revolutionary. If you watch what he's doing with robot tech, you compare it to like the closest competitor robot, Pepper. I think it's Pepper.
I think it's Pepper, yeah.
If you compare it to Pepper, which is this robot that a lot of banks and Japanese companies use for like interacting with customers, dude, they don't even compare.
Yeah.
The technology is leagues ahead within Ori Labs.
Yeah.
So a lot of folks are looking at him as this shake-up, disruptive guy, and they want him to stop, not because he's helping people, but because he's disrupting a business.
Yeah.
He's being almost competitive. And he doesn't intend to. He talks about, again, this this attitude of, I'm just here to help people. I just want folks to be enabled because I know what it's like. I know how miserable this is. That's all I care. But in a late capitalist society, and we've discussed at length how much we hate capitalism, it's kind of difficult to put your best foot forward. But Ori Labs, for sure, is just one. You have a couple others. Talk about these others as well, because they're just as amazing. I don't want to yet. Oh, okay. What else you want to say about Ori? Oh, you want to save it for another...
No, I don't. I'm just pausing for dramatic effect. No, I just wanted to say one last thing just to give him like a little bit of extra praise that is, again, from an American perspective, mind-blowing. The little Orihime costs $400.
What? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, I want one.
If this was in America, well, you have to be in Japan.
Still,
so,
I want one.
with disabilities and stuff. But... it only costs $400. If this was America, that thing would cost $4 million.
Oh, fuck yeah. It's like insulin.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be $100 for a shot. It'd be $800 for a shot. Fuck you.
Oh, did you want to live? Did you want to experience life? Okay, well, you're going to have to be a billionaire first. Yeah. Stupid. No, but yeah, $400. Pretty good.
Wow.
Okay, so on to the next one. This one was more just cute. It's called Robert. It's this extremely strong but super gentle, very heavily padded. And then they dress it all up like this cute little bear.
Oh, he's so cute.
Yeah.
I mean, he's kind of creepy below the waist, but he's cute everywhere else.
Yeah, if you just look at the top part. But this thing was to help combat, we've talked about this a bunch, that with the rising population and not really knowing what to do with older people, they're kind of having to innovate. Robear is this really cute robot specifically designed to help pick up elderly.
Yep.
It can pick them up by like their underarms, or it could just straight up hold them leg over one arm, back on the other arm, and then set them into their wheelchair. That's the whole thing, is it just picks them out of bed, puts them in their wheelchair. Pretty simple design, but it's really cute and obviously super effective and needed in a place like Japan. And honestly, could be useful in most countries, because even here in America, we don't really tend to take care of our elders as much as we probably should. But yeah, this one was just more of a cute little one-off. I don't really have too much to say about it. Definitely look it up, though. I love his little face. It's so fun.
And then what do you have the next one here?
The next one. This one.
Oh, this
is fucking sick.
Yes, this was so... I saw the pictures of this and was just blown away. Yeah.
So this one is from a company called Cyberdyne. And they have these really cool exoskeletons called HAL. Hybrid Assistive Limb. Now, when I first saw these, I was genuinely like, oh, this must be a movie prop or something. Because as far as I was aware, exoskeletons still, to this day, weren't a thing.
Kind of, yeah, still sci-fi-ish.
This came out in 2004.
Wow.
Yeah, I was like, wait, hold on a second. What's happening here? Japanese brand. Has existed in Japan for a while. This is just to help people that don't have full mobility or can't quite hold themselves, and helps reteach them and assist them in walking. It's in Japan. They introduced themselves into Europe shortly after. And then in 2018, I think it was 2018. Was it 2018? The FDA here in the US. Yeah, 2018. The FDA actually approved them for use here in America.
For rehabilitative services.
Yes.
Basically. Yeah.
Yes. They also suggested potentially using this even if you are fully able, just to help give
for repetitive tasks and stuff that could be physically damaging. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super super cool. But here's the kicker. When I was researching them, I found out that Ozzy Osbourne has been using them.
Yeah, I saw the article you posted. Because here. That's crazy. I didn't know
because
that.
Because he has Parkinson's. And this helps him move and keep active and helps, you know, helps him stay walking.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of different places in the US to do this. But the thing that like quadrupled my interest was this random study that they did in Japan that completely like tore my brain in half, because I was like, first of all, why would you do this? They took 28 people with chronic heart failure.
Oh, yikes. Okay.
And added and used this on them. The thing that's incredible is that the people who used HAL recovered in 7 days versus the people who did conventional therapy took them a lot longer.
Holy shit.
Yeah, okay. I was like, well, I had to read it a couple times because I was like, wait a second. Why? heart failure, I thought we were talking about legs. Apparently, people with chronic heart failure they can't move very often because their heart's not pumping blood
around.
Right,
makes sense, yeah.
But because of these legs, it allows them to get their heart pumping without...
Exceeding.
Without using their muscles and stuff. And they recover like within a couple days.
Holy shit. Yeah, I'm looking at... There's a bunch of studies quoted on here.
Yeah. It's insane.
Wow.
They say that HAL helps with like spinal cord injury, cerebral palsy, strokes, chronic lower back pain, muscular dystrophy, Parkinson's disease, all sorts of things. There's almost too much to talk about here. I don't even know, I just start putting out random little stats here, like a middle-aged woman who couldn't move her right leg after a car accident 5 years prior spent 3 months with HAL and regained her ability to jog.
Yeah, I'm
like, that's insane.
I'm looking at all the different places they've used this rehabilitation, especially in the US. And here's what's crazy for me. You could lease one directly from Cyberdyne. Now, the unit we're talking here is a full lower limb model. So a full support for either leg.
Yeah.
Only $35,000 per year. Now, pause for a second. I get, for a lot of folks, that's a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
Like, if you have an average salary, there goes half of it.
Yeah.
And certainly if you're on Medicare or whatever, that's an exorbitant amount of money. But I want to point out, 35 grand is nothing mm-hmm. to keep extending your life year on year on year on year on year because you are now performing activities that could be harmful to you in a safe way. In like, again, you know, talking about the positives, right, of Japanese robotics and Japanese technology and the things that Japan is doing well. Japan has a unique situation that I think is really cool. If you look at all three of the robots we've just mentioned, and yes, all of them do have sort of the healthcare slash medical.
Personally, I'm really into like medical healthcare. Well, we're both transhumanists to begin with. And like my idea of technology is that it should help me be better and more relaxed and easier. Like,
yes,
my dream is to have a nice robot lady cook me dinner and clean my house and do the, you know, all the outside chores. So I could just be a lazy fuck. You know what I mean? I want like some random cyber arm that just like does shit for me.
Yeah.
That's all really cool. So obviously I went more this route. There's plenty of other robots out here, but this is just fucking, all this shit's so cool.
What's interesting about Japan is in a unique spot right now. If you're listening to this and you're into STEM, especially if you're in the college collegiate age, please, 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 please consider going to Japan as an option. Mm-hmm. Japan, remember when we were talking those stats earlier, right? Only, 29 universities in Japan have technology programs that are actively producing engineers and programmers and developers. That's not much. There's not a lot of student outflow from Japanese universities producing technology. Folks are becoming salarymen and salarywomen, and hey, fine, that's okay. But that's why the Japanese population is struggling to innovate. If you are from the US or Britain or France, I don't care, from anywhere, and you have a passion about technology, please go to Japan, because they're in a unique societal position right now. Mm-hmm. Japan is in a spot where they have to innovate to survive. The Japanese population is plummeting. The economy is plummeting. Japan is being forced to open itself to foreign work and being forced to open itself to foreigners just to survive on a day-to-day basis. In the meantime, its population is rapidly continuing to age.
Yeah.
Its younger population is leaving. Its middle-aged population is overworked. There is so much room in every technology sector for innovation that doesn't need to be capitalist slime.
Yeah.
You don't need to go to Japan and introduce Japan to the next great social media algorithm or introduce Japan to the next great banking algorithm. This isn't what they're looking for.
Yeah.
They're looking for stuff like this. How are you helping people continue to farm? Helping people and continue to handle medical care and elder care? How are you helping people with transportation, earthquake proofing, disaster response, military defense, all this stuff? These are all really critical aspects of Japan's economy and industry, and they're all struggling because they're not getting people. Because at the end of the day, technology doesn't create itself. There's no magical system of just tomorrow Japan has rockets, or you know, that's such a dumb. Japan is not going to wake up tomorrow and have miracle technology sitting in its basket unless somebody comes along and says, you know, I got an idea. And every single one of these stories, you know, we mentioned three just to summarize, like Ori Labs, Robear, and then HAL. All three of these systems was a Japanese person and some foreigners involved as well, it looks like, sitting down and going, you know, I could do what Japan normally does, automotive industry, or I could say, fuck it.
Yeah.
I want to do something cooler than that. And it'll help people while I'm at it. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, I don't give a shit about the capitalist side of things. Right. I want to talk about a couple other things really quick that I didn't put in the agenda, but just came to mind, and I do want to point them out. The Tom Scott video we watched about the guy producing hovercraft.
Yes. I was going
to
add him into my thing too, but I couldn't really find like a condensed article on it.
Yeah, we don't have a source for it, but please go watch Tom Scott's channel on YouTube. First of all, Tom Scott's incredible, and he's currently like taking a massive break and or retired. What a wonderful individual he was, though. but Tom Scott did a video on a Japanese gentleman who is creating hover bikes, essentially, like hovercraft.
Yeah,
he's not doing it for any capitalist sense of profit. Yeah. The dude's...
Well, the thing was... he created it because there's certain kids that couldn't participate in the PE that's required.
Yeah.
So he made a bike that would allow them to be physical in a way that they were able to be physical.
Yes. That would still require them to use balance and agility, but not in a running, jumping, sprinting sort of way. Cause you know, if you're Japan doesn't have an obesity epidemic, but they are beginning to experience obesity on a level that the US is more familiar with, or Britain.
Yeah.
They're starting to find that out. Japanese genetics, as it mixes and mingles more with foreign genetics, means you're naturally introducing genetic mutation. That means Japan's disability count is increasing, which is just the natural consequence of being human. And throughout all of this, Japanese technology is, instead of pursuing the capitalist side of, we're going to produce this because this is really marketable somewhere.
Yeah.
Japan's going, nah, this could really help some people. It'd be fun.
Yeah.
And like the guy, like you mentioned, you know, like we were talking about with the hovercraft, he just did it because, yeah, some kids at PE might like having this. This would be kind of cool if they could participate in bikes and sports and other stuff. Yeah.
Well, he was like the school janitor or something, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a custodian, and he wanted kids to be able to bike was the big thing, because you can't, if you don't have physical use of your lower body, and I'm not talking like being a paralytic. This isn't going to be any better for a paralytic.
Right.
But if you're just someone who struggles to bike because you just don't have that physical stamina or that strength, the hover bike is a great option.
Yeah.
You can still drive yourself in a way that doesn't knock you over. It's not momentum based. And the other guys we've seen, the one guy building the little Gundam robots. This is actually another great one. I don't have an article for it. It's another Tom Scott video. But there is another robot company that's working on building mech suits, right? And of course, everybody falls straight to the stupid cliche of weaponizing. Yeah. And of course, sadly, he has given into some of that peer pressure, and he's made a couple videos of putting some, you know, laser tag stuff on them, right? But here's the thing. That's not why he created them.
Yeah.
He created these mech suits because Japan, being incredibly mountainous, incredibly treacherous, extremely terrain unforgiving, you're not driving cars and trucks everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Even with Japan's incredible infrastructure network, the work that needs to be done is off of that infrastructure network. If you want to build a Shinkansen line to a new city, you're not doing that shit across flat land, dude.
Yeah.
You're going across some seriously shitty terrain.
Yeah.
And even by modern standards, tunneling's still not safe.
Mm-hmm.
Boring is, or I guess that's tunneling, but it's still not safe.
Yeah.
Cresting mountains and building roads on cliff sides is not safe.
Yeah.
You're building bridges across, you know, you see bridge accidents in China all the time. These and they're using automated bridge builders to keep people safe, and they're still collapsing because engineering is engineering. It's going to fuck up sometimes and people get hurt.
Yeah.
This kind of technology is opening that up for people where people are less in harm's way, like with HAL, being able to make people who can't lift consistently lift consistently. You're saving them in advance of whatever disability they could accrue.
Yeah.
They've gone from having weak muscles to strong muscles, and now they've got skeletal support and exoskeletons for unhealthy people, or not unhealthy, for folks struggling with physical disabilities is the future, as opposed to having to support them once they're already crippled. Mm-hmm. Why not support them before they reach that point? You can almost see like a progression in this technology. Oh, you don't have you have a physical or mental disability and you need to have work. You're completely immobile. Mm-hmm. You're bedridden, truly bedridden. You're not even getting in a wheelchair. Ori Labs has you covered. We're going to make sure you are a functioning member of society. Mm-hmm. You will be treated as an equal. Oh, one more thing real quick. I'm going to digress on that topic because it's really important to me. America has been very good at treating folks with disabilities as equals.
Yeah.
But America has another problem, and that is the three-legged puppy problem. Which is Americans struggle to look at someone with Down syndrome, with MS, muscular dystrophy, or any other physical ailment and not look down on them by accident. I do not mean that Americans intend to be shitheads. I'm just saying when an American looks at a person with a disability like Down syndrome, you have this almost, reaction.
Yeah.
I promise it's not a hostile one, but it's just that natural reaction. I'm autistic. When people find that out, I almost always get this almost, oh, I'm so sorry. That's so horrible.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I wasn't looking for pity. I was just telling you so you were aware.
Yeah.
The Dawn videos are the most wholesome fucking things. Because at no point do any of the clientele visiting this restaurant, and I hope this continues, foreigners, I swear to God, if you fuck this up, if you ever, if you ever go to Japan and fuck this up for the rest of us, I will find you.
Yeah.
I will find you and I will harm you in ways that are not legal for me to say over this microphone. Do not fuck it up for the rest of us.
We don't need the Kyoto situation happening in
For fuck's sake. Yeah.
Dawn Cafe. I want to go there first.
Yeah. Please. let us have our joy. But the clientele are not going to Dawn Cafe and belittling or talking down to these folks with disabilities. They're treating them just like they would other servers.
Yeah.
They're having conversations. They're ordering food. They're not sitting there and babying them. And by the way, the folks with disabilities aren't requesting to be babied.
Right.
In fact, we were watching videos where they wanted to speak English to foreigners. Yeah. Where they're like, I've never gotten to do this before because I couldn't leave my house. So how the hell am I supposed to interact with a foreigner? At least an average Japanese server working in McDonald's, whatever. You might interact with some foreigners across your day. Great. Right. You get some English practice. But what if you're completely bed? There's no fucking way you're going out in a gurney to interact with foreigners.
Yeah.
Now they can. And for them, this is like, there's so many hidden little gems of talented musicians, talented singers, talented like performers. Mm. Talented English speakers that you would never have known if you hadn't enabled them to do this. Yeah. That's why the Ori Lab stuff is just ridiculously wholesome. If you just want to spend a day feeling good about humanity, the Ori Labs YouTube channel will and any review anyone does of Ori Labs will definitely scratch that itch for you.
Yeah, it's very cute.
So kind of in conclusion, before we close our episode down for the day, again, Japanese technology, you're going to see two types of videos on YouTube. You're going to see creators talking about how Japan is this futuristic, crazy fucking future world, which it is not. Japan is struggling so much to compete in a way that's
meaningful. When I first started researching for this, I just typed in Japanese robotics, and it was all just this half-boiled... No, it wasn't even Gundam stuff, actually, surprisingly.
Oh, what was it?
It was just half-baked AI garbage. That was just AI imagery of this is the future that had all the stereotypes that we talked about earlier. Yeah. And it was it was just some random 3-minute video about how cool Japan is. And I was like,
yeah,
Jesus.
And
okay.
I like how whatever. The gate censored you from saying Jesus.
Yeah, no, I said the naughty word. And
but the thing is, Yu is right. When you type into Google, if you type into Japanese technology, you're going to get this cliche shit that makes you think that Japanese is really futuristic, like flying cars. It's just, there is a startup in Japan that's working on flying cars. It's one of 100 possible businesses to support.
Right.
And it's only getting press because it fits the stereotype.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be getting press for the light of day if it wasn't.
Right.
Like
Ori
Labs.
From all over the world have been working on flying cars since this is not
fucking new.
Yeah.
But the opposite, sadly, is also true. There are a lot of videos you'll find on YouTube shitting on Japan, going, oh, Japan's ancient. They don't have tap to pay. They they're still a cash-based society. They use fax machines and landlines. Their cars are all polluting pieces of shit. That's all true, too. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Japan, they won't embrace nuclear power, and they've had disasters and all this stuff. And the Japanese government is really bad at handling these disasters. Yes, this is all very, very true. But the problem is, you should think about this for a second if you're listening to us, or if you're watching this back on Twitch. If you are hearing these two videos, they're at extremes.
Yeah.
One's extremely positive, the other's extremely negative. If you have any ounce of ethics in you, your brain, a red flag should go off, and you should go, wait a minute, we're missing a perspective here. We've got the extreme positive and negative, but where's the middle? Where's the unbiased fact of where Japan is? And where Japan is it's in need of passionate people in tech. And unless it gets passionate, and it doesn't matter where they come from, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if they're Japanese or not. But in the absence of talented, passionate folks who go, wow, there's an opportunity here, and I'm not talking capitalistic, fuck off with that.
Mm-hmm.
If without people going, there's a real opportunity to make a difference here, it's just going to stay where it is. And unfortunately, both stereotypes will continue.
Yeah.
And for us, for you and I, we're not going to perpetuate these stereotypes. Like, we've talked many times about what kind of content we wanted to produce in the podcast, what kind of visual content we want to produce when that day and time comes. We don't want to produce clickbait. We don't care. We want to portray this in a way that inspires you, the listener or viewer, to contribute. Because yes, Japan may be homogenized and 99% Japanese, and it doesn't really view foreign assistance or sort of foreign intervention as a positive thing.
Yeah.
But if you go to Japan to join Ori Labs, and they are hiring, they often are, and you could be a difference maker in a way that Japan needs. And if there's any way you're going to get the Japanese to embrace you, maybe not as a native, but as someone they love and adore, that is a great route to that.
Yeah.
That really is. If you're going to do it the right way, going over for anime, we love anime, that's not the way to do it. Going over for sushi, that's great food, but that's not a reason to go over.
Yeah.
To go over to make a difference in the Japanese public's life because of their aging population, their medical healthcare problems, and everything else, that is a great reason to go to Japan. And, you know, at some point we'll talk about our own ambitions to go to Japan. You know, mine is to work in the theater industry because Japan's theater industry struggles a lot. There's not a lot of creativity there.
Yeah.
Not as much as there used to be, you know, in the mid 1900s. There's not a lot of effort to make the music scene more accessible to folks. And that's the world I'm passionate about, right? Mm. But without folks being willing to step up, again, things are just going to stay the same. So please, if you're interested, this is a great opportunity. Anyway, now that we've finished, this is our first time ever doing a sort of special episode, and I really enjoyed it. Like, it was a lot of fun. And we're not going to be doing them all the time because, God, one, we can ramble a lot, and then it just ends up being this long-ass episode, and nobody wants that. But at the same token, like, I want to make sure that we're producing, like, quality content, and it's hard to do research for this kind of stuff because it's like, we want to be really thorough. So if you enjoyed the content, please do write in fan mail or hate mail. If you really disliked it, let us know. Or if you want to fact check us, please do. We do make mistakes.
Yeah.
You can write in to us at shinigamiloveapples.podcast@gmail.com. Also hit us up on Threads, Shinigami Love Apples. That's where we are most active. And we'd love to chat with you and get some more ideas for you from you for future bonus content just like this. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the episode. We will see you next week. I was Shinigami Pin Pin. That was Shinigami Yu Yu, and you've been listening to the Shinigami Love Apples podcast. We'll see you next week.